Hello, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of the ReWrap podcast. Today, Karaminder and I are honored to be joined by Dr. Robert Hurt, who is going to give us an insider's perspective into what it takes to retrieve, process, and release images taken from satellites, much like the ones we've all been seeing this week from the New Horizons satellite as it passed Pluto. Dr. Hurt holds a PhD in physics from the University of California, Los Angeles, and is a member of the Infrared Processing and Analysis Center at the California Institute of Technology. Among a number of NASA projects he handles in his role at Caltech, he devotes much of his time to processing infrared images from missions, including the Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer and the Spitzer Space Telescope. Since 2006, he has hosted a video podcast called The Hidden Universe, and often speaks on subjects of using new media to communicate science and astronomy. Dr. Hurt, thank you for joining us. It's extremely exciting to have you here.
It's my pleasure to be here, and congratulations for tripping through one of the most multi-syllabic intros you probably have had to do for a while.
Yeah, when they sent that to me as what you what you've done, I was like, oh, this is quite impressive. Hopefully I can get through this. I also hope you don't mind that I call you Dr. Hurt. I noticed that in many of the things where your name is listed, you just go by Robert Hurt. But I saw you had a PhD, so I didn't want to call you Mr. Hurt.
You can call me Dr. Hurt. You can call me Dr. Bob. You can call me Robert, whatever you like. So
I like
I'll respond Bob. To any of them.
So Karaminder and I have probably more questions than our brains are capable of expressing like in one go. Like, there's so much out there for this. So I guess
yes, I lots of questions.
Maybe start at one end of the spectrum and work our way down. That is to say, was like, what is the process for capturing an image from space, either from a satellite or from Earth using a really powerful telescope? Like, what's going on?
Walk us
up
through
there. Yeah. How is the data sent back to us? Like, what kind of files are we talking about when it finally gets to us?
Sure. No, that's a really good place to start. So the main difference, I think, between normal astronomical data collection in terms of images and sort of what we're used to as sort of earthbound photography is the fact that astronomy is sort of intrinsically monochromatic in the way that it works, right? We're using detectors that are sending back basically a single grayscale image. Now, that image may be obtained through a filter. It may be obtained through a particular detector that is sensitive to one specific part of the spectrum versus another. But you know, we're only getting back sort of one channel of information at a time. And so typically what will happen is, I'll talk to the Spitzer Space Telescope project, which is sort of my core work. Mm-hmm. That's an infrared observatory. It's floating off in space. It's actually in its own orbit around the sun, slowly getting further and further away from the Earth. It's actually currently a little further away from the Earth than the Earth is from the sun right now. So it's drifting around the sun. And Spitzer, during its cryo mission, actually had seven primary channels of imaging that it could do at different wavelengths in the infrared spectrum. One instrument, the IRAC camera, basically had four channels of infrared light ranging from 3.6 to 8 microns, so sort of wavelengths of light roughly like 10 times longer than what our eyes can see. Mm-hmm. And the MIPS instrument would actually pick up at 24 microns and do 70 and 160 microns, so on to much longer wavelengths of light. So whenever Spitzer did imaging, it would basically do a bunch of mosaics using these cameras. I think the other thing that's interesting about a lot of the cameras on space telescopes is that they're not nearly as high a pixel count as what we're used to.
Yeah, I recall reading somewhere that the New Horizons had something like a 16.1 megapixel camera on it.
Yeah, it's we have to have electronics that survive launches and in space and radiation exposure. So they tend to actually be pixels are pricey. So we try to be very efficient with the pixels we have, and we do a lot of mosaicing. For instance, the imaging cameras on Spitzer, the IRAC instruments are a mere 256 by 256. Right? Don't even have like a megapixel of a single exposure. But what we lack in single frame pixels, we can make up for in mosaicing. So for a lot of missions, when you see beautiful wide field images, you're actually looking at like dozens, hundreds, even thousands of individual images that were taken, you know, imagine, you know, holding your iPhone and just snap, like 1,000 times, and then trying to mesh that all together into a single coherent image with preserving astronomical coordinates and proportions. It's a lot of what astronomy is today is made possible by really, really good software written by very clever people.
So it's software that's putting that together.
Is it automated?
It is automated to varying degrees with a lot of hand-tweakable parameters. For instance, one of the most incredible image product to come out of the Spitzer project, which in itself is it's an observatory class mission that doesn't have enough time on, you know, its lifetime to image the entire sky, but it can get big chunks of it. And we did a survey of the entire plane of the Milky Way galaxy. This is a 360-degree strip around the sky, around 2 degrees tall, give or take, depending on where we're looking. And that actually, it was composed of, each channel of that was composed of many, many hundreds of thousands of individual images. Wow. That then people spent literally years, of course, the life of Spitzer, writing the software to be able to take all of those images and then mosaic them together to get one clean panorama that the software looks for things like cosmic rays that cause glitches on the detector, then knows when to subtract those out, and then basically puts that all together to make these nice uniform tiles that are pieced together. So that's... other software is written for other custom purposes, and we have a pipeline that, you know, is uniformly used just for the basic data for anyone's project that comes through Spitzer. But yeah, there's a lot of magic that happens really before the data even gets into the hands of the researchers. Now, if you need to, you can always go back to the individual frames. If there are things you have to study, if you're looking for things that might be changing over time, right? You might care about, you know, was this how much what happened in one frame versus another. But for most of the images that you see for a final image, right, that was just stacked up, added together, and built through software, many times hands-off.
Wow.
But then that's just the start, right?
Oh. Yeah, go ahead, Karen.
I was going to say, how long does this process take? Like, you know, because you get images feeding back to you, and the process you're just describing, Robert, where the software is going in and, say, making and stacking the pictures and getting it going for you. Is that a many hours or days operation?
I mean, it depends on how big a part of the sky that you're working on. But, you know, in general, if for just a given set of observations, you know, it's a fairly quick process. It's, you know, you do that in, you know, under a few minutes for... you know, if you're just trying to work with a limited spot, you know, one particular region on the sky. But, you know, when you start trying to deal with thousands of images you're mosaicing together, then yeah, now you're starting to talk about much longer processing times. You know, some of the stuff can, you know, literally take, you know, weeks to run through if you're working on huge data sets that you're trying to process all in parallel. So,
So let me ask you then, I'm looking at two photos here. One of them is the single photo of Pluto on a black against a black sky that we saw like yesterday, and then another one I've seen a part of the Andromeda galaxy from this Hubble Space Telescope, and it's like this long panorama of like just an edge of that galaxy.
Right.
Compare those two, the kind of data that you would be, how long it would take to get them, how long it would take to transfer that data back to Earth, and what the files look like when you get them.
Right. So yeah, those are two good kind of opposite ends of the spectrum astronomical images to deal with. Now, the simple one is the Pluto one, right? Because that is a single exposure from a single instrument. And the Pluto data set is actually very bandwidth limited by our ability to receive data from the New Horizons mission. I believe the current baud rate that we get using the Deep Space Network communicating with Deep Horizons, if I'm remembering, was something around 3,000 kilobits. So we're talking pretty early AOL dial-up era data speeds.
Wait, 3,000 kilobits, that's 3 megabytes a second.
Yeah.
Is it a second?
Yeah. Well, no, it's 3,000 kilobits.
No, you got to divide that by 8.
Kilobits. Yeah.
So kilobits, let me see. That's
even smaller. That's like what? That's one part of a kilobyte.
Yeah. So divide by 8 to get to bytes.
375... it's not bytes. It's got to be 375 kilobytes. Yeah.
It's slow. It's really slow.
It's slow, right? So in fact, what's going to happen with New Horizons is the reason we're not seeing a lot of pictures right now is it takes time to the spacecraft, when it's communicating to Earth, has to dedicate itself to simply downloading information to Earth. And that means it can't be doing observations. And since New Horizons is just whizzing past Pluto super fast and is not going to slow down, there's no fuel to brake at that point. The way the missions work is that it's worded a few little early images back just so that there's something to be safe, just in case something terrible happened. And then it stopped transmitting to us. And then it just focused on image, observation, data collection. It beeped a little, hey, I'm still alive, signal back, to make everyone happy, and then it kind of passed. Then what's going to happen is they're going to spend the next, I believe, 16 months downloading all the data that was collected over the last few days.
Now, what's the frequency, or at least how is the... It's not the speed of light for the communication that what you're downloading, say 375 kilobytes a second. Is that a radio, or is that... How does it get back to us?
So it's just beaming a radio transmission back to us. That's, you know, it's coming at the speed of light, but the speed of light, that's actually over 4 hours, I believe, to get from New Horizons to the deep space network dishes on Earth.
I'm going to say something I thought I'd never say about NASA. That's not so bad. 4 hours. That's not so bad.
Well, yeah, until you have the telescope go into safe mode and you have this 8-hour round trip to try to send questions of what's wrong, waiting for the answer to then go and get it out. Had a little bit of a scare a couple weeks ago when it had some kind of software glitch they had to compensate for the flyby. So
as it gets farther away too, because it's going outside the solar system now, right? It's still going. Is that going to mean it's going to take longer? The longer they wait to get more stuff from it, the longer it's going to take to get the data off it?
Exactly. The data rate is a function of distance to the Earth. And so, yeah, the data rate will be going down as time goes on. So it does slow down the rate. And the data is being received on Earth by NASA's Deep Space Network, which is a network of very large radio dishes. They've got 3 installations around the world that have dishes up to 70 meters in diameter that they train at this. And this is the same network of dishes that receive all of the data from Mars. They receive all of the data from NASA's array of space telescopes, like the Spitzer mission and the Kepler mission. We have to actually timeshare. NASA has to timeshare all of its missions on getting data back from Saturn, getting data back from Mars, getting information from Pluto, getting information from Spitzer. And so that's all a big scheduling nightmare that someone has to deal with from just data flow logistics. And that's part of the reason why it'll take 16 months. It's not, it could actually download everything faster than that if we spent 24/7 telescopes trained on it, but we have to share. We have to play nice with all the other missions too. So New Horizon gets its share, and then we go and do other things as well.
So to go back on my original question, so this one photo of Pluto that I'm looking at, that was one shot done and it sent it back. Now this other one from the Hubble Space Telescope, that one, I'm guessing, is thousands of photos combined, and
yes,
it took much longer to produce.
Right. Now, I know the picture very well, actually. My colleagues over at Space Telescope Science Institute worked on that one. It's a huge and just incredible, lovely image where you are just seeing, taking the light of the nearest spiral galaxy, Andromeda, and imaging at such a sharp resolution with Hubble that it really breaks into myriads of individual stars that you can now see and study through this. I don't remember exactly how many fields went into that, but because they do, the cameras on Hubble are definitely bigger than the cameras on Spitzer, but they still don't cover a lot of area. They have to do a lot of exposures. Hubble, here's another trade-off that you get in astronomy. There's image sharpness, your resolution, versus your field of view. Okay, so Spitzer only has a 256 by 256 array because infrared light is intrinsically at a lower resolution than visible, and Spitzer has a smaller mirror, which also makes it lower resolution. Those pixels cover more area of the sky. So Spitzer, while it won't have the sharpness of Spitzer, while it won't have the sharpness of Hubble working in the infrared light like it does, and being a smaller mirror like it is, the trade-off is it gets to actually look at more of the sky as part of the process. And so we can see a much larger swath of the universe in the infrared. So with Hubble, right, they have this incredible sharpness and these relatively large detectors and the advanced camera for surveys. But to get something as big as Andromeda, you know, they that's why they only did about a third of it. They just the amount of time, the number of orbits that it would take Hubble just to image that one galaxy would eat into the science of other projects, too. So sometimes you have to then make a judgment call like, you know, well, we can image maybe a third of Andromeda, and that will give us all we need to do to get the primary answers from science that we want out of it. You know, that's enough of the sampling of the stars in that galaxy that we can actually do meaningful studies and across different regions of the galaxy. And really, we can get all the knowledge out of it, even if we don't have a single picture that covers, say, the entire expanse of the galaxy.
Mm-hmm. Who exactly makes that call, Robert?
All of the time that is decided for observatory class missions like Hubble and like Spitzer and like the Chandra X-ray Observatory, this is all done through a science application process where people basically write proposals for this is how they want to use the telescope. These are they identify the science they want to accomplish, their strategy for accomplishing it, and how it fits into the context of what we know and what we're pushing forward. And then this all goes in front of a committee that sort of picks and chooses, because we invariably have many times more requests for observing time than we can actually satisfy with hours in the day of the telescope. Right. And so you have to sort of prioritize and pick which we think are the best arguments. On top of that, there's a little bit of time called discretionary time, usually director's discretionary time, in case something pops up out of sequence of the normal application process, but it's interesting. Mm-hmm. They reserve a little bit of time to point at sort of the unexpected and or maybe finish out a nice image that might work for public purposes, but it alone may not have the science justification.
Got it. And is there any like philosophy to this committee's mindset? If I know this is probably far reaching into more science fiction, but if like there's projects of like, well, I don't know, possible human habitat here, so maybe we should invest more time into this observation mission. Anything like that? Any kind of core philosophies that they kind of abide by or lean towards for make decision-making process?
I think it's a balance. It's always an attempt to be a fair balance between pragmatism of, you know, do we really think this is going to work? Will they get the science they want? Versus the possibility of discovery. And so the kinds of things that get chosen for observing time, I think, are an effort to balance, you know, sort of guaranteed returns versus the possibility of serendipity and discovery. So there's always going to be an element to that. As an example, there's another mission, the Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer, which was it's an infrared telescope that over the course of a year surveyed the entire sky in the infrared. Again, trade-off, it was a slightly smaller telescope than Spitzer, slightly lower resolution, not as deep, but as a result, it got to do the whole sky as part of the process. So again, you have this trade-off of sharpness versus depth and coverage. And so I know, for instance, there was a project using the data, the archival data from that, to look for hints of extraterrestrial civilizations in the form of Dyson spheres. This is a sci-fi concept that was actually proposed by the scientist Freeman Dyson as a possibility. If you had a very, very advanced civilization that reached a technological point that they basically would want to harness the entire energy output of their star, the idea that you could build, sort of cannibalize all the material in your solar system and build a shell of, probably not a solid shell, but a sparse shell of material encompassing the entire star that would basically try to harness as much of the light as possible, giving you access to the entire energy output of a star for your civilization. Wow. At that point. And one of the consequences of a race that did this is that it would have a very unique infrared thermal signature, because still having to obey the laws of physics, even if you absorbed all that light, you would still have waste radiation going out in terms of heat. So yeah, pretty far-fetched idea, but it's still worth poking, because, you know, you can parameterize it, you can make a hypothesis, there's a way of studying it. And so, yeah, you take a stab and you see. Now, sadly, I don't think this Dyson Sphere project turned up any hits, but, you know, we spent some time looking.
I think I want to wrap this conversation a little bit back towards the photos. And one of the questions I want to ask is, what does the photo that you get from a satellite, what is it? Is it like, is it a raw file, a TIFF, a JPEG? And then what does it actually look like compared to what we see when it's finally released to the public? And maybe we can use these two examples again. Maybe we can look at Mars too, some of the Mars rover shots. But like the Pluto, Andromeda, and then maybe that Marathon Valley photo that was taken by the rover Opportunity.
Sure. There are a lot of similarities in those. Let me say, I don't actually work with planetary data myself, so I'm not as sure as data formats that they use.
You're going to be more sure than we are. Yeah. That much is
for sure. It's kind of similar. And for the astrophysical stuff, you know, the stuff coming from the you know, looking sort of outside the solar system, I'll talk to that because that I actually understand. Mm-hmm. We have a data format we call FITS, a Flexible Image Transport System. It was something devised back in the 70s, actually, in the early days of building digital detectors. And it basically returns what's effectively like the total count of the, if you will, like the total number of photons that got hit, detected by the detector. It's a raster array data. It's just, you know, it's its own file format, like a TIFF or something. It's lossless, you know, right? We don't want to lose any data. But the most interesting thing about it, I believe, is also that it's intrinsically high dynamic range. We're basically counting everything that gets to that detector, and a well-designed project will do a readout before you actually oversaturate anything. And so the kinds of data sets we work with are sort of, by their very nature, high dynamic range. You'd point the telescope at a bright star-forming region, and the brightest, youngest stars would be incredibly bright compared to, say, the faintest nebula that of dust and gas out there. But we try to capture that entire dynamic range of data so that we can basically make a full analysis of the science in there. For the planetary missions, they may not tend to be quite as high dynamic range as we do for astrophysical, because they're also working with a more limited range of, you know, normal daylight illuminations. But even so, you're going to find there's going to be a lot more information in those than, say, something that just comes off of a DSLR camera, right? Because mm-hmm. you're still trying to catch an image that you've exposed into the shadows, and you can get all the information you need there, but you haven't burned in the highlights, so you can analyze what happens on that side as well. An interesting example of where that's come into play recently isn't at Pluto, but the other exciting thing happening this year, which is the Dawn mission visiting the dwarf planet Ceres in the asteroid belt. And this is that big ball of sort of protoplanet that has those mysterious bright white spots on it. Mm-hmm. And with the earliest images from that, those things looked like they were just blinding, glowing balls of light on the surface of this dwarf planet. But that, in part, was an illusion due to the exposures chosen for imaging Ceres, because Ceres is a very dark, dusty object. It's got basically the reflectance of asphalt, okay? But the exposures were being done to bring out the full detail. So the ball looked like a big white ice ball, and then something that's really bright on that surface then actually gets blown out and oversaturates and gives you kind of the astronomical equivalent of lens flares. But when then they discovered there were these bright white spots and they started changing the exposures, then you could actually start to see the detail, but it made the rest of the planet look dark, like a dark dust ball that it actually is. And so in some sense, the early images were less representative of what it would look like to our eye, because they were just trying to up the exposure to show all the details they could on the surface. But, you know, if you have something, you know, if you drop a snowball on asphalt and you expose for the asphalt, the snowball is going to look like it's luminescent and glowing right. bright. Yeah. Whereas if you readjust your exposure for the snowball, now the asphalt looks really, really, really dark, but now you'll see features in the snowball. And that's the game that they're having to play on Ceres to understand what these bright patches are, which could well be patches of icy material, you know, on asphalt, if you will. So exposure is definitely a part of that. So what happens then, we have this data set that represents as much of the dynamic range as we can capture. Then we need to make that into a grayscale image we can display on a monitor in 256 shades. So you sort of have to go and do dynamic range processing on it. You might apply mathematical functions to it, like logarithms or arcsync functions, to sort of compress the dynamic range of the image, so you sort of see all the highlights and the shadows all at the same time. There are these are processes you can do that preserve relative brightness, right? That you can sort of do a mathematical process on it. That sort of it's like a gamma correction, right? You're mm-hmm. you're just operating uniformly across the whole image. Versus other kinds of HDR processing that are used photographically that do localized corrections over bits and pieces, right? Those can make very pretty Harry Potter-esque results, but you know, you no longer can count on two things in the image having the same brightness actually being the same brightness before, right? When you do that kind of HDR processing, you introduce sort of non-linear effects across the image that mean that things might get pumped up in the same brightness, but they may be actually different brightnesses in the original data. So for the science, right, we want to make sure we preserve as much as possible on relative brightness. We don't want to make something look brighter just because it pops out more in the photo at the end. So then add the other dimension to that, of course, we also deal with color. Most of the astronomy images you see are beautiful and colorful. And that has to be done as a post-process because, like I said, the data comes as a single channel, a single filter, a single band of light. And then what we do is we take 2, 3, 4 or more of these, and we then have to map those into color channels and combine those together to then produce the full color images that we see as a final product.
I think a good example of this might be, I'm looking at 1, 2, 3, and it's like there's 4 black and white photos, and then there's 4 that start to come into color, and we have an animated GIF that we're going to show.
I think it's the Orion.
It's the Orion from taken Wise. On the Wise, yeah. Mm-hmm. So these are 4 black and white frames I'm looking at. So are these 4 separate frames that you worked with, and then did you actually work on this particular image?
If it's Wise, then I did. Yes.
Okay.
I'm not quite sure which one you're looking at, but yes.
So the description we have on it was the Orion Nebula M42 as imaged by NASA's Wide Field WISE, infrared wavelength representations from left to right, green, red, green, blue, cyan, raw 3-channel level adjustment, 4th cyan channel, and final Photoshop composite.
Yep.
This is a stunning photo.
Yeah.
And it's crazy to look at what you started with. Can you just tell us what you were doing and how that worked and how you did it?
Sure. So this is an interesting example too, because again, because we're working with multispectral data sets outside of human eyesight, right? The idea of 3 channels of information, red, green, and blue, that's a purely biological limitation. That's just mm-hmm. that's a happenstance of how human eyesight happens to work. There's nothing fundamental about red, green, and blue for the rest of the universe. So in this particular case, WISE has 4 imaging channels in the infrared. And there's information in all of them. So ideally, you want to preserve all that information in a final image. So what we've done for a lot of the infrared data sets that have come through, in fact, most of them, and WISE is the same, what we'll do is we'll actually preserve the relative ordering of light. Red light has a longer wavelength than blue light. So we'll take whatever the longest representations we're pulling from the WISE telescope, and for the ones that have the longest wavelengths, those are the ones we'll tend to map into the red channels when we sort of translate that back into red, green, and blue. And then whereas the shortest infrared wavelengths, we'll pop those into the blue channel, and then, intermediate goes into green. So if we only had 3, it would be pretty straightforward. We would just take the short one, put it into the blue channel, the intermediate one, put it in the green channel, and the long one, put it in the red channel, adjust the levels between the 3 channels appropriately, and you get a color image. Why is we had that 4th channel we wanted to use. So the question is, where do we color map that? Where does that fall in the spectrum? So another consideration is kind of grouping like to like. And this is where really knowing how color works and how the eye interacts with color and how the human perception of color works helps you make some decisions. For instance, if you have 2 channels of information that are very, very similar in the physics that they sample, like the first 2 channels of the WISE mission sample primarily light from stars. They're infrared light, but morphologically they tend to be fairly similar. So it makes sense to map those into 2 colors that are relatively close to one another, because you're not going to see anything if you map them into very different colors. They'll average together to some intermediate shade. Whereas the third WISE and the fourth WISE channels actually are showing very different physics. The third one is showing the light of organic molecules in dust clouds that are luminescing under illumination from stars. And the fourth channel is showing the thermal glow of dust, dust that's been heated up and is re-radiating in infrared as a function of its intrinsic temperature. So those are different kinds of physics. They don't always line up. And where they don't line up, you know, that tells you something about one process is happening in one area and a different is in the other. So you want those in different color channels so that those differences really stand out. But the things that are kind of similar, the two channels of starlight, those will just go into a blue and maybe a cyan. So the second wise channel will contribute a little bit to the green channel. It also has the advantage of taking the pure blue you would get if you just put the starlight into a blue channel. And by adding a little cyan to a second channel, it desaturates the blues a little bit, makes them a little more friendly to the eye, easier to print. And then if you choose, you know, your colors carefully, right, you'll get a very pleasant intermingling of how it works between the blue and the green and the red. I mean, the way we do this practically is, you know, using applications like Photoshop or whatnot. We can use blending modes to combine. The screen blending mode is actually a very useful one for these kind of things, because you can basically create different color channels of intermediate colors, and you screen them together, and the screen makes sure that you don't just completely blow out a color by like what you would get if you were just doing a linear addition of color. And so it gives you the opportunity to go beyond just a green channel and a red channel and a blue channel. You can blend in a cyan or an orange or, you know, whatever seems appropriate for the data set.
This is fascinating to me, because like colors, and like now you're bringing into stuff that I sort of understand better, which is like the Photoshop and what you're actually doing. But there seems to be quite a bit that you yourself, which probably makes you why you're a doctor and I'm not, is you know so much about how light is supposed to look to us that you're able to make these, you just understand it better than I think I ever could.
It's, well, you know, it's been a process of years, and it's, for me, it's been informed by the fact that I've, you know, art has been a hobby of mine since I was a kid, and photography as well, and, you know, I was an early user of you know, image software, and, you know, even in grad school, putting the images together for the paper was always a lot more interesting to me than writing the words for the paper, so... that's how my advisor got me to, the carrot my advisor used to get me to like write my papers, like, well, start with the figures and then write the words later, you know. But that kind of balancing, you know, the photography and what we do to make an image look pretty, the software tools like Photoshop and the techniques that we use with that to really take and get the most out of a photo, it's learning that you can do those same techniques. They apply very much to astronomical data sets as well. And but yeah, there is a lot. I learned a lot about just the nature of red, green, blue, and how the human perception of color. These things just sort of come with the field when you really have to build color from scratch every time, right? You learn a lot. There are things like you know, the difference between the RGB color wheel and the artistic color wheel, right? They're the same color wheels, but the proportions are done differently. It's because the human eye, for someone with full color vision, right, we actually perceive more distinct colors between the red and the green than we do between the green and the blue or the blue and the red. You know, between red and green, we go from red and orange and yellow and green. These are all distinct, clear colors to us. Mm-hmm. Between green and blue, you know, we basically get cyan, but most people who aren't really trained in color would just call that light blue anyway, and they just think right. of it as blue. You know, again, between blue and red, we get like magenta, but again, people it's just think pink. Of that as purple, pink or purple. You know, and yeah. so and pink and purple are basically the same thing, just at a different saturation or a different brightness, right? So as a result, you know, you can play games like if you have two data sets that you know are very, very similar but have subtle differences, then you can get a lot more out of mapping them to red and green than you would between, say, putting them to green and blue. Because subtle differences between green and blue, they'll just kind of mush out and you won't see it. But subtle differences between red and green, right, you get the yellows and the oranges between those two extremes, and then you have a lot more to play with to sort of coax out information.
So let's say somebody tells you we need this picture processed for public release. You take it. You spend how many hours? I'm basically asking, how long does it take you to do something like this Orion photo that we're looking at? And then you hand it off to someone who puts it into a NASA press release. Is that basically what happens?
Yeah, that's pretty much the process. And the time it takes is largely a function of just, you know, how big is the image. And, you know, again, if you're shooting DSLRs, right, you know how big your picture is every time. And, mm-hmm. You know, you have a workflow for it. But we can work on a small area. We can work on a huge area. So, you know, the pixel count can change radically from one image to another, just depending on the field of view that you want for that project. And so obviously it takes more time than more pixels. Just there's more manipulations you've got to do and slows the process down. But for a really carefully done piece, it can easily take me between 1 and several days to really get it all nailed down, because there's the process of going from the raw astronomical data to the grayscale representation. There is then, you know, sometimes aligning them, because sometimes it doesn't all come pre-aligned, right? You might actually, especially if you're combining things from different telescopes, the data sets may not line up, and so you'll have to use distortion and warp tools to get things to line up properly channel by channel. Then you apply the colors. You have to find the right application of colors, especially if you're doing a novel combination that isn't part of a standard process that you're working on. Then you need to adjust each channel, the levels and the curves for each channel, because you want to bring out the colors that are intrinsic to the data, but not end up creating colors that aren't really there, but that you can bring out by sort of over-processing. So here's again where the science side of it comes in, you know, knowing the difference between, is that color really showing something that's real about the universe, or is it, have I basically done the astronomy equivalent of applying an Instagram filter to just make it look orange? Because
you know what the truth is, and we're depending on you to keep telling us what the truth is, or that's on your shoulders.
Or he's interpreting what the truth is, right? That's kind of as best as science can do.
Yes. It's interpreting it really is an interpretation. And there's another term that was invented in the 70s, and I and all of my peers who do this kind of science visualization uniformly agree that we hate it, and we're trying to get people to stop using it, and that's this term of false color. You probably heard the idea of a false color image, right. The term was coined with all the best intentions in mind, because in an era where basically all photos that had color were just color film, the idea that you might be able to make a color image out of something that really wasn't really originally red, green, and blue light, or that you've somehow enhanced it to bring out features. They wanted a term to let people know that, oh, this isn't actually like a photo. But the very use of the term false color actually implies there's something dodgy that's going on, something unpleasant about it.
Untruthful?
Untruthful about it. And that is what we really rail against, because there have been so many misconceptions about, you know, mucking with the colors of the universe. Articles that have been written implying that the images that you get from Hubble or other telescopes are somehow fake because they're not just real red, green, and blue. And kind of missing the whole point that there's red, green, and blue is just an arbitrary human consideration. You know, that even other species on our planet happen to have different color receptors than we do. You know, they see color differently. And the idea that these colors aren't, I like to think of it, the colors aren't false, they're just misunderstood.
And these colors need to go to therapy.
The people analyzing the colors need to go to therapy. The colors are just fine. But I actually think of it more as a translation, right? We're taking colors that the eye can't see, and we're translating them back into colors that we can see. You know, it's the image equivalent of taking a piece of text written in Mandarin Chinese and rewriting it in English. It's an accurate representation, but re-rendered in a language that other people can read.
It's translation.
Translation, yeah.
Yeah. All right, so I have, Robert, this, when reading kind of like the background that was sent to us, you, when you're actually, you know, layering these things and you're getting rid of, let's say, cosmic rays, which I think we saw in that the Orion shot, the GIF that's animated, that'll be in the post as well. And you have to say that you can't you have to be very careful about what you remove. Like, you know, you can't just rubber stamp stuff out because you could be erasing science. And so you use different, I'm guessing, you know, library of images to make sure, like, nope, that's there. And I think what I have is space dust, or, you know, that's a lot of pressure. Like, that's a lot of, like, I guess, circles around different things you do. And then, like, okay, follow up and make sure that this is good and clean.
Yeah, no, this is the most complicated and most difficult part, I think, of the whole process, because this is where you don't want to do something that's considered to be modifying the data. You don't want to rewrite the universe to your own taste, right? There are aspects of what I do that, you know, in some sense are akin to glamour photography for the stars. I mean, I live in Los Angeles. You have to always put this in context that people around here understand. the idea, but the difference is, you know, I guess where you want to make the comparison, if you want to say go to the glamour photography model, right? You know, there's one kind of thing you can Photoshop in a glamour photo is you can go through and you can clean up you know, dust specks or you know, insects that were in the foreground, or if you were working with original photographic film, you know, if there were scratches on the negative or something, right? You can do something to restore the image to its original, removing artifacts, defects from the imaging process. The other thing you can do in glamour photography is you can paint out a mole or bring in that little belly just a little more so it looks slimmer, right? You know, you can,
right,
you can actually improve the content by modifying what the truth was, right?
But you can't liquefy the galaxy is what you're saying.
Right, right. You know, what we want to do is the first thing I said. We don't want to do the second thing. And so that's the most time-consuming part of the process then is going in and using the same kind of imagery touching tools that you would use to, you know, work on any photograph at a, you know, a really fine level, but going in and identifying and removing the things that are instrumental artifacts. And one of the reasons that this is actually very, very important is that people actually look at these things in incredible detail sometimes when they go out there. And if you leave something in an image that is a known artifact of a detector or, you know, a bad pixel, you open up the possibility that someone will look at that and actually think, oh, look, there's a giant black planet sitting in the middle of this nebula, when in fact, that's a known bad pixel on the array, right? And so you don't want to leave something in these images that we put out for public consumption that actually conveys the idea that there is an actual physical thing in space that has that look and appearance, because that actually is more misleading than going in and reconstructing what it should look like without these flaws. And so that process, that's again where I wear my astronomer hat as I go through and do this. I can't just go willy-nilly and take out anything that looks like a nasty little ick on the picture. I have to know the difference between a glint and a bad pixel and a diffraction spike and a readout error and you know, all of these things, right? This is, again, just the sort of thing, you know, is you build up over time working with data sets for a given telescope. You learn to identify this stuff. And then sometimes I go in and there have been cases where I sort of look and I'm not actually sure about something. I have to go back to the original researchers and say, hey, take a look at this. Is this thing real, or do we leave this one in, or is this a known artifact?
So the last thing you want to do is be responsible for a new cult that arises because of some conspiracy theory, because of something you deleted.
You know,
that's heavy.
there are entire cottage industries out there surrounded, built up around trying to find these things. The scientists that are working with the various solar observatories, there are all sorts of issues that they have. They have cosmic ray hits that from the sun and a lot of detector problems that go in. But they also crank out a lot of images, so they don't go in and they don't try to fix up all the known glitches and artifacts. Well,
it's not,
you know, they
phones.
Can have bad pixels that look like sort of black spots. There are whole websites devoted to finding all of the hidden planet X's that got imaged by the SOHO mission or SDO, and they will go and they'll look at these things pixel by pixel, looking for anything that could be a UFO or an alien or Earth's twin that astronomers are hiding from you, you know, and it gets really, really crazy. one thing that actually happened to me, we had an image we had to rush out for a conference, and I was actually leaving town to go to the conference myself. I didn't have time to work on the image, so we just ran the image that the scientists had just assembled themselves using the their analysis software without any of the cleanup we normally do, and there happened to be an image glint that sometimes a bright star will cause kind of a secondary image, another location in the picture. You know, it's, we understand it. We know exactly where those happen. They have a very particular shape. There happened to be a glint in that one. Didn't really think about it. You know, it didn't mess up the image. But a year later, we had a much more we had a much expanded version of that same region. We wanted to re-release that to show it as a much bigger picture. That one I actually went in and then cleaned up all the glints and so forth. That was not out a day before we got an email from someone saying, I noticed that there was a skull-shaped object that appeared in this region in the earlier picture that's missing. Is this possibly an asteroid that you captured while it was going through? It's like, oh my God. There are people who are doing, like, you know, A-B comparisons, you know, I mean, they weren't in the same layout or anything. This person had to do a lot of work to discover this. And you know, they want these things. Now, of course, right, asteroid would probably have to be hitting us before we would even... It would be more than a pixel across in our data set. But yeah, it's that kind of thing. If you leave things that we know aren't real in it, they can become real to people. And especially if they compare that with other images where suddenly it's in one and not in the other. So it's actually significant. And another story that I actually heard one of our early project managers for Spitzer, Bill Green, had years ago worked on the Viking landers to Mars. So these were the missions that brought our first look of what Mars looked like from the ground. And I remember as a kid seeing this on TV and being so excited. And I remember seeing the first ever image from Mars. It actually showed the lander, the orange soil, and a blue sky. And I remember seeing this on TV vividly because I'd been waiting for this. Then the subsequent images didn't have the blue sky. They had more of an orangey, whitish sky. And when we were having a party for him when he left the project, I actually said, by the way, do you know anything about this? And he's looking at me and said, oh, do I know something about this? They were working on the image. The press people came by and said, we need an image for the news tonight. And here, what's on your screen? Let's use that. And he was doing the image processing and said, well, we haven't finished running the color calibration, right? They had little swatches of color that they imaged so they would know how to basically adjust your color correction. You get your basic color. Because we didn't know what the colors on Mars were intrinsically, right? How does the light get filtered through the air? We didn't know these things. So they weren't done with their color analysis, and they had to give them the picture, and the picture ran on the evening news. Then they finally looked at the color calibrating targets, and they figured out what they had to do to adjust the images to get the correct rendering of color on the surface of Mars. And then all the other images basically showed this familiar pink sky due to all the dust. The color of the dust basically colors the sky. But because the first image that came from NASA was a blue sky, and a blue sky clearly means it's inhabitable by you know, creatures.
Oh, clearly, clearly.
There are, I encourage you to go Google, like, Mars blue sky, and you will find entire websites devoted to how you take pictures from the Mars missions and do the correct Photoshop corrections to get the actual blue sky that ought to be there, that NASA has hidden from us from the very first day that we were ever on Mars.
yeah, you and your nefarious deeds trying to hide the truth from people.
Yes. I'm always fascinated with the conspiracy theories on NASA that we're hiding all the evidence for the creatures and critters running around Mars, because the idea that the one piece of information that would pretty much guarantee NASA's budget to be through the roof for the rest of our lives would be the one we'd actually choose to hide from the public.
Well, it's the Intergalactic Federation that's preventing you from doing that.
Sorry. Prime Directive. Yeah.
So, Robert, I have a question about, you know, how you release, you know, kind of how along the lines of what people out there are doing. Have you ever gotten where you released all this raw data and people developed their own tools to, say, look at it or put it together or have their own interpretation of how they think it should be done? Or basically, by you putting out the raw material out there, has anyone kind of, say, open sourced or developed tools to help you do what you do, or to have a different interpretation or translation from what you guys do?
Well, there are a lot of different tool sets out there for astronomy imaging. And astronomy actually has an incredibly active amateur community. And I use the term amateur very loosely because so many of the so-called amateur setups have detectors that are completely research quality, and these people can devote tremendous amounts of time to creating these beautiful, highly detailed images. They do the exact same image analysis and processing that any professional astronomer do to work with their ground-based data, and there's a lot of software suites out there that are optimized for this. And I mean, their end goal almost always is simply to produce the nicest possible imagery of the sky, not for a specific analysis of one field or another, though the data is easily of full analysis quality. So. I occasionally make use of some of the tools that the astronomy imaging community uses for the aesthetics. Sometimes there are things that work better in that than some of the tools that we've developed in-house. Years ago, I worked with some collaborators at the European Southern Observatory and the European Space Agency Hubble office in Garching, Germany, and we've collaborated on a project to build something we called the Photoshop Fits Liberator. It was a plugin for Photoshop initially that's now a standalone application that will basically read that Fits data format for astronomical images and output it as a TIFF with the 8-bit or 16-bit, you know, if you wanted to get more dynamic range out of your image. And we basically did that to solve our own problem, which is we want to get this Fits data into an image format that we can put into an image editor and work and use the tools that are far more sophisticated for doing photography than the tools that we use for analyzing the data in terms of image display. The weakest area, I think, in research astronomy now is that the tools for image analysis and image display are just incredibly rudimentary compared to the tools that everyone else in the universe uses for photography and video and so forth. And so we've never, our interfaces got kind of frozen circa 1989 and have never adapted well, I think. So there's so many more flexible tools in the photography world for doing this work. And like I say, bring out real imagery, real color, real structure, things that are of scientific interest. So. Yeah, there's a real reason to kind of go that way. I think I lost the thread of what you were asking, but there was an answer somewhere in there, right?
I think you answered it.
I think
my last question for you, Robert, before we let you go, is we're seeing humongous advancements in the last couple of years in sensor technology in the consumer market and the pro market here on Earth. And I'm wondering if you're seeing any of that in what you're doing. Is the type of sensors that they're putting in satellites, are they getting better? Are they getting astronomically better than the rate we're seeing down here? Or are you guys still using the technology that you've relied on for many years just because you know it works and the way that it transfers data over those distances can be trusted?
Well, the way that technology filters into astronomy, particularly space-based astronomy, and this is true for both planetary missions and as well as telescope, like the astronomical observatory missions, right? The time frame for developing these missions can easily be longer than a decade. Mm. And so a lot of decisions have to be made well in advance of when a mission launches. As a for instance, we have the James Webb Space Telescope, the new, you know, incredibly huge 4-meter class space mission that's supposed to launch in, I believe we're targeting October 2018 right now. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's 3 years from now. All that hardware has been built for a while. So, if someone came out with a really cool new infrared detector today, we haven't been able to touch that design for a real long time.
And so by the time you maybe do get to touch it, it's not as cool as it once was.
Right. By the time it's in space, you know, that's already decade-old tech.
And then it's got to get out to someplace where it takes pictures. And so then we finally get them. And then it seems like, oh, why are you still using that camera?
Right. Now, I think the planetary science community potentially can benefit more from this than the astronomy community, because a lot of times the astronomy community is working outside the visible light spectrum. And that pushes us into a whole different chip technology. If you receiving light at 3 microns, 5 microns, 10 microns, right? You need a completely different detector technology than you use for visible light. So some of that tech is actually spilled over from the military, infrared detectors. There's a defense reasons to build really good high resolution infrared detection, and so that I think has helped push the astronomy infrared community along over time. When you build X-ray telescopes, then you need a completely different kind of optics and detection system. You know, just the idea of how do you even focus an X-ray, the whole idea of a lens or a mirror goes out the window because
right.
You know, the X-rays simply go right through the mirror that we use. That doesn't help you at all. You have to use different properties of materials in order to find other novel ways to focus those. And then likewise, the way the detectors work have to be built very, very differently. So there's definitely an advancement, but there's also a lag. And
yeah,
you'll
never
totally fly with the latest and greatest, right? It's even worse than the automotive industry. You know, how long it takes, you know, the new electronics feature they plugged into the car that was a really cool idea 5 years ago, right?
Right, but it's commonplace elsewhere now. So it's like, oh, finally you put it in there.
Right.
Okay, that makes sense. It's got to be a little bit disappointing that you don't get to play with the newest stuff and get it out there. And like, why don't we just like replace it and get it and send it out there? So at least it's newer, but it makes a lot of sense.
But I'm sure, like Robert, the advancements in software have let this older tech get either more money out of it or more juice out of it, but you're able to do more with it with software innovation.
Well, you've really fingered something important right there, because it is the ability to build a platform that's flexible enough that you have that ability to go in and use software to kind of re-engineer its functionality is what kind of drives a lot of the innovation. When the Spitzer mission launched, one of the things that we were very clearly not going to be doing was any exoplanet science. Because Spitzer was never designed to do exoplanet science. It was not considered to have the sensitivity necessary for it. But when, as Spitzer's mission was going on, the people on the ground were thinking, hey, you know something, what if we did this and this? We actually might be able to work around what we thought was a limit. So today, Spitzer has actually won a very important mission for following up on exoplanet discoveries. We have a pixel on a detector that has been characterized to a degree to which no pixel in history has ever been studied. You know, out of that 256 by 256, there is an exopixel on there. And the pointing of our telescope, we found ways after launch to improve it significantly beyond the spec of the system, which even came down to changing the cycling of when a certain heater would turn on the spacecraft and to warm the electronics, because we found that just a tiny little pulse of heat was causing a little flex in the shape of the telescope that translated to a slight periodic change in pointing. And simply by changing the timing of it, we were able to flatten that out and let it point. So now we can basically put a star on an exact sweet spot of a particular pixel and have the sensitivity to be able to detect the faint trace of, you know, the loss of light when a planet moves in front of the star, or sometimes even the loss of light from the planet itself as that planet gets eclipsed behind the star. So, yeah, you know, it actually blows my mind how clever the collaboration between the scientists on the project and the engineers on the project can use just the hardware platform coupled with incredible improvements to the software to basically turn it into a completely different kind of tool.
That basically wraps up one of the most intellectually filled conversations I think Kerminder and I have had, probably the number one intellectually filled conversation we've had since we launched this podcast. And for me, it's
I'm going to need a few days to digest.
Yeah. This. I got to sit and I got to think real hard, because this is the first time since I've done this since college. So, Robert, it was a real pleasure having you on here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank
you. Do you have like Robert. An Instagram or a Twitter or anything like that where people can tell you how cool you are?
I would say just kind of follow us on, to be honest, I try really hard not to be a dinosaur, but Twitter is the one thing I just don't have the hours in my life to make that happen. So I would actually just suggest people follow us on the Spitzer Space Telescope. Actually has a Facebook page, and we try to keep that updated. And it also has a it has a Twitter account. So I'd say keep a look there. That would be NASA Spitzer, at NASA Spitzer.
Sweet. We'll put that in the show notes too, so everyone knows where that is. Robert, thanks again for joining us. Everyone, this has been a special edition of the Rerap Podcast. You can catch us every Tuesday as Karen Minter and I talk about the latest and greatest in the photo, video, and lifestyle world. This definitely qualifies as the greatest. So, thanks a lot, everyone, for joining us. If you have any questions, you send them to rerap@resourcemagonline.com, and we'll see you next week.